to Beat 104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.
Good afternoon, everybody. Flight to Classics is brought to you today by 4Play Delhi Sheraton Mall and this radio station, the Beat 104 in a class by itself. Welcome.
Trini Guyanese cuisine at its best.
4Play Delhi's got it.
We've got that taste you won't forget.
4Play Delhi.
Oh, how we aim to please ya. We wrap the rotis in front of ya. Great service with a smile, got your taste buds going wild. Rice and beef, salt, fish, chicken, lamb, and doubles on the list. You just can't refuse it at 4Play Delhi. We got the taste you won't forget.
4Play Delhi, located at Sheraton Mall.
Good afternoon and welcome aboard Flight 104 to Classics. Today, our aircraft is under the command of Captain Phil Forrester. The captain has informed me that our flying time will be approximately 3 hours to Classics International Airport. At this time, we ask that you fasten your seatbelts and increase the volume levels in your system as we perform our demonstration. Thank you for your attention. We will be airborne shortly.
Oh yeah, I like it a lot. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome aboard Flight to Classics for another Sunday afternoon. And we are delighted to have you on board. Now, this afternoon, our aircraft will be taking off towards the east of Barbados. And at 2,500 feet, we'll make that left turn along the northeastern coast of our island. Those sitting on the left of the aircraft will obviously see the Wyndham Sam Lord's Castle, and the Bridgetown Port will be away in the distance to our left. As we exit the island, you'll notice the billowing smoke coming out of the cement plant there in Checker Hall, St. Lucie. It's quite spectacular, to say the least. And we will continue in a northerly direction over St. Lucia, despite the fact that it is cloudy over there as we speak. Grosley and Cap Estates will be optical below us. We continue in that northerly direction over Martinique, a left turn into the Caribbean Sea. And by the way, despite the fact that the radar is saying that there will be some precipitation in the area of Hispaniola, I can assure you it will be absolutely innocuous, as this aircraft is designed to stand resolute against the attack of any adversarial weather. So what I'm saying, essentially, it will be a smooth flight to Classics International Airport. Now, you already know the story. I am your ordained minister of Classics. Ordained and certified. And that's the reason why I'll be playing you loads of classics this afternoon that will absolutely bring you rivers and oceans of delight. Now, 4Play Delhi is providing our food. Of course, we got to get some food up in there. Loads of rotis will be served this afternoon to your delight. And in particular, the veg rotis, and for the pescatarians, we'll have dolphin and potato rotis, all right? So it's going to be great. And not to mention, though, vegetables will be served as well. Pumpkin, chana, potato will be served on the side, along with your favorite juices, tamarind, mango, lemonade, and of course, bottled water. So yeah, it's going to be a great flight to Classics International Airport. Sit back, relax, enjoy. Flight attendants, prepare for departure and cross-check. Now, let me tell you about the weather. The present temperature is 30 degrees Celsius. The relative humidity is 76%. The wind is blowing from the east southeast at 24 kilometers per hour. The tide is low at the moment, but it will rise again at 8:27 tonight. The sun will set in the northwest at 6:16 this evening, but it will rise gloriously from the east at 5:32 tomorrow morning. Today's forecast: mostly cloudy with a 76% chance of precipitation. And I guess we're all delighted that the weather has relented, considering how belligerent the heat had been over the last couple of months, the extent to which our skin tone has changed, though. It has ravished our complexions. quite frankly, and a lot of us have become unrecognizable here in Barbados, to be honest. But having said that, climate change and global warming have become central to our conversation here in the Caribbean. That's the truth. Now, during the past few years, there have been soaring high temperatures that I just alluded to, the extent to which we've never witnessed before. Now, sea levels have been rising above normal. There have been coastline erosion, unseasonal flash flooding, as well as an increase in the frequency of tropical storms and catastrophic hurricanes, many of which have destroyed homes and businesses both here in the Caribbean and many areas along the U.S. southeastern coast. Now, the Earth's surface is now 1.2 degrees centigrade warmer than it used to be, and suffice to say, in the last decade, temperatures have been the warmest compared to preceding ones. But the question is, what's the relevance of climate change to energy transformation? That's the question right there. Now, here to talk about this is Christina Alston, chairwoman of the Bahamas Power and Light, and Warren Andrews. He's a 30-year veteran electrical engineer from Atlanta, Georgia, who currently works with the government of the Bahamas in strategic partnership with the Bahamas Power and Light Company. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm sandwiched between two distinguished engineers.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to Barbados to both of you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate you coming on board our flight. Now, I know that, Christina, you've come to Barbados before. What are your impressions of Barbados?
So I love Barbados. I mean, it's one of my favorite islands to come to. Mm-hmm. I like going down. I like to eat fish. I mean, there's just a lot to see and do here. Mm-hmm. There's some similarities to the Bahamas, but mm-hmm. there's a lot different geographically. You all have mountains, or what we would definitely consider a mountain in the Bahamas, you all have. But, you know, we have small hills.
Small hills. There you go. Oh, my goodness. Have you ever heard of Horse Hill? It's pretty steep, though.
No, I haven't heard of that. Okay.
Yeah. And Warren, your impression, this is your
third time
coming to Barbados. What are your impressions of Barbados?
I love the country, mm-hmm. love the breeze, mm. love the people.
And you love the Hilton Hotel.
I love the Hilton Hotel.
And the food at Four Play Deli.
But I would like to, and the food at Four Play Deli. The double's nice, man.
Now, Christina, I am so curious about you because I have, quite frankly, never met anyone from the Bahamas. Never, ever, ever. So therefore, I'd like to find out from you about what was it like growing up as a child in the Bahamas?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question. So I was actually born in Freeport, but my family is from Roxanne de Luthra. So one of the things that I think people may not realize is we are an archipelago. And so we have quite a few inhabited islands, small islands, big islands. Of course, New Providence is the capital, but, you know, growing up in the Bahamas is like growing up in other, you know, Caribbean and West Indian countries. You know, you wear a school uniform, you know, you have beef patties for lunch. I mean, you know, you eat a lot of fish.
Yeah.
But I will tell you that my husband is American, and I would say that his experiences have really opened up my eyes to what it means being Bahamian. You know, like him experiencing Junkanoo for the first time, him eating, you know, stew fish and grits for breakfast. You know, those experiences for him, it is eye-opening for me as a Bahamian. And then taking Warren to the Bahamas, it's eye-opening for him because you get to see your country in with fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there may not be a lot of Bahamians. You know, it's a country of about 400,000 people. But there's so many things that are exciting right now. But growing up as a child, you see the changes, but then you also see the things that stay the same from a cultural perspective.
Now, let's talk about your career. Now, exciting is the word I'd use to describe it. Impressive is another word. But I read that you received your Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering from the University of Florida.
No. From Florida State University.
Florida State. I humbly apologize for my innocent indiscretion right there. I'm seeing it here. I'm saying the wrong thing. I got to get a pair of glasses, Malcolm X. Do you have any glasses?
Yes, we can sort you out.
You can sort me out tomorrow. Yes. I'll come to see you tomorrow. But to be continued, you've since had an outstanding career in the Bahamian utility sector, working in both generation transmission and utility roles. My question is, what motivated you to pursue a career in electrical engineering, which is kind of unusual for a woman, though? Is it?
Obviously, yes. I mean, there's not that many women electrical engineers running around, and especially those in the power industry. But for me, my story begins like a lot of other engineers. You know, you see a problem and you want to solve it. And so for myself, it really came down to growing up as a child. You know, you kind of asked me about growing up in the Bahamas. And so my home in Freeport, where my family, my dad and my mom live, we had electricity. But when I would go to the family islands to visit my Grammy, she didn't have electricity. She lived in like a two-room clapboard house, and she had a kerosene stove and a pump, and, you know, she kind of bathed us in the front yard in the tin bucket. But that experience really solidified for me in my mind that the lack of electricity really impacted people's lives. And so from that time, from a small child, you know, 5-6 years old, it was definitely like rural electrification is my life. And, you know, like I built my first solar water heater at 11, and I just was fascinated about energy in a way that not only it is produced, but how it's consumed.
Now, could you give us an insight as to what, into your specialization, what do electrical engineers actually do?
Well, so we do a lot of things, but everything that you touch at this moment in time is driven by electrical engineers. I mean, whether it's electronics, whether it's computers, but at the very core, in the energy sector, imagine what you could not do if energy did not exist.
Right.
And so for us, even in this lovely place that you have where you're working, there is nothing that you have here that an electrical engineer didn't touch. From the lights, to the communications, to the internet, all of that is what we do.
Now, I want to talk about your role as chairwoman of the Bahamian Power and Light. And I want to ask you, how has your training been able to excite your area of specialization?
So, being chairwoman of BPL, it's a multifaceted transformation that we are going through. For me, what prepared me for this is, so I would have worked for 6 utilities. I would have worked for quasi-government. I would have worked for rural electorates, municipalities, investor-owned utilities in several roles. But what makes BPL different from every other utility that one would work with is that every single island has its own generation. So we don't get economies of scale. Mm-hmm. You know, we have about 27 power stations in the Bahamas, yet we are only serving 400,000 people. And when you think about that, that means every island has to have a bucket truck. Every island has to have, a digger. Every island has to have people there working, whether it's 10 people on the island or 200,000 or 300,000 people on the island. The government has made that commitment that no matter where you live, no matter how far-fetched it is, you get the same level of service in terms of us trying to provide you with electricity. And I think that that is a complex place to be, because where you have one island here, it's very easy to get economies of scale, but we don't have that as an advantage.
Now, your job, I suppose, it's quite a high profile job, if you like. Now, how did the opportunity to be head of this prestigious organization come about?
So our Prime Minister, Brave Davis, really set the vision. In his view, he really knew that in order to change people's lives, we really had to start with the most basic of needs, which is energy. And so we were in a position where we had aging infrastructure, the company was in quite a bit of debt. Our reliability was not quite where it should be. And so PM Davis set the vision. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, he created, come about the Ministry of Energy and Transport, which is new for us. And so that would have come about in October of 2023. Mm-hmm. And that is headed by the Honorable JoBeth Colby Davis, who is a dynamo in her own right. If she's listening, she's probably smiling when I said that. But she came from the energy sector. And so PM paired she and I together, and we picked up the gauntlet and we went with it. And so what has come out of this, we have an energy committee that meets every Monday. And so from there, we looked at how do you transform the energy sector in a way that is meaningful to even the person in, say, Long Island or the person in the Abacos? And so by raising everyone up simultaneously, we're able to start to really address the issues in the energy sector.
And which brings me to the next question, wonderfully, or perfectly better said, how would you describe your role as chairwoman of the Bahamas Power and Light? And what are the challenges involved with overseeing the energy resources of those islands, especially when there is tropical storm and hurricane impacting the islands?
So resiliency is something that it impacts us all. And so the difference between resiliency and reliability is quite different. So reliability is the goal. Resiliency is the solution to get you to the goal. And it's one, you can choose a variety of platforms for your resiliency, because every level of resiliency comes with a price tag, and you have to understand that. So, but one of the things that we have to really recognize is when we talk about the resiliency, is the resiliency of the employees of Bahamas Power and Light. You know, it's headed by a really great CEO, the first woman CEO that we have, which is Toni Seymour. We have an excellent C-suite that supports her. And it's, as chairman, what I do is we try to sit in this space of corporate governance. And so we sit there and we try to make sure that we're leading the organization in the way and supporting the C-suite through this transformation. Because it is a very, very big transformation that we're going through.
You know, Christina, it is fitting that I raise this issue with you, and that's the issue of gender discrimination, which quite frankly still remains an outstanding one, especially in areas of engineering and energy. Now, what have been your experience with gender bias during your career?
So a lot of the gender bias that I experience is from microaggressions. And when I say microaggressions, it's where individuals may question your seat at the table. Like you may walk into a room and they want you to qualify why you have a
despite seat. The fact that you're qualified.
Yeah? Right. And so they want you to somehow justify and qualify why you have a seat at the table. And for me, I no longer engage in those conversations because I'm of an age now where once women become of a more mature age, we just choose not to, you know, there's certain fights we like.
That, you can tell somebody where to get off.
Yeah, that's on you. I mean, my favorite saying now, when people come to me with microaggressions, I just look at them and say, my LinkedIn page is up to date. If you'd like to make a professional connection, please reach out. And then I walk away.
I love it.
The savage of it all.
Yep.
But the other part is, though, is the reaching back and making sure that you're having conversations with younger women. But one of the most important things that, as a woman, that I've had to learn is to make sure that I keep what another engineer has termed as the North Star. What is the goal? Sometimes the journey is important, but it's only important if the North Star is set. And a lot of times I have the pre-meeting, which is the meeting before the meeting, where I have to find a man as an advocate to make sure that my voice is heard, because sometimes men only can hear other men. And that's not really my fault or my problem. My where I take control of that conversation is if I go to a man who I know can become an advocate for my voice, and I say, listen, here's the situation. I need you now to sit down and explain to these other men what is being said. Am I happy about that? No. But if it gets me to the North Star, I have to stay focused and maintain. That's the goal. And I have to put my own ego to the side to accomplish the goal.
Mm. Oh, that is that. Magnanimous is the word, isn't it? But I want to say to you, Christine, that as you are aware, our world has changed drastically over the last decade in particular. The emergence of artificial intelligence, which quite frankly will make some jobs expendable, underscores this. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, now different world. Now, how different is the landscape now compared to when you first entered the industry, given what I just mentioned about artificial intelligence and the emergence of new technology?
So I will tell you that up until maybe 20 years ago, we generated and transmitted and distributed energy the same way we had done for 100 years before that. Mm. Nothing had changed. Mm. We boiled water, we ran generators, we moved electricity. Mm. But in the last 20 years, we have experienced such change in our industry. We went from an industry where we almost paid people not to use energy to an industry where we want you to use more energy, to an industry now with artificial intelligence that we can't even control the amount of energy that people are wanting to use. And so as an industry, we've gone through a tremendous amount of change. And I will say this, as it comes to artificial intelligence, I use artificial intelligence every day. And I use it in a way for clarity. I use it in a way, I'm teaching my AI to be my other half, to understand, am I saying this correct? Because I've actually loaded up things that I've written and I say, take this and use my voice to write this. And I will often say, go out and do this research and come back with the references that I need. And then I'll reload it and say, now go and check and make sure that we're not missing anything. And it's those open-ended questions that I find are the most effective in the AI space.
And to your point, to what extent will it make human beings expendable?
So there, I don't see it as an expendable. It is what is different about us now. I mean, one of the things that we talk about with BPL in terms of our energy transformation is we have technology. I go back to the if you all, well, you might be too young, but you remember we used to have the bag phone?
Yeah.
And we went from the bag phone, and then we had this, and then, you know, and then we have cell phones. There's a whole generation that only knows about cell phones, yeah. But there are some of us who remember the bag phone.
We live the both generations, yeah.
So what we're seeing, and one of the things that BPL is being able to take advantage of is this leapfrog of technology. So we're going from the bag phone to the cell phone and not those iterations in the middle. And so that's something that all of us in the Caribbean have. We have old equipment on the system, and we can take advantage of eliminating that intermediary step.
Now, Warren, thank you so much indeed. Warren, let's talk about you.
Yes, Cap.
You're sitting there quiet, but I know you got a lot of voice. So we're going to hear your voice right now. Now, you were born in Guyana, but migrated to the United States when you were just with the rest of your siblings, when you were just 8 years old.
Right.
What are some of your memories growing up in Queens, New York?
Growing up in Queens, New York was very interesting, and looking back was typical for an eight-year-old on the way up, growing up in that community. My parents made sure that we never wanted for anything. It's until I got older I realized the sacrifice they made to make that happen. But most of my memories are fond memories. I went to school in one of the toughest areas in Queens, I would say. And that had its own challenges, but it made me tougher as a person.
Yep.
And learning how to navigate, you know, relationships, especially at a young age, I think is where I honed in those skills, growing up in Canberra Heights, Queens, and also when going to school in Hollis, Queens, and going to high school in Jamaica, Queens.
Now, let's talk about your education, mm-hmm. the shoulders upon which your outstanding career now stands. Mm-hmm. You earned your degree in electrical engineering from Hofstra University, New mm-hmm. York, and you're also a certified management professional. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose electrical engineering as your specialization?
Well, I think all engineers have this story. Engineers by nature are curious and problem solvers, right? So I remember I had a paper route since I was 10 years old, and I remember always not wanting to be a burden on my parents. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to get a job, get money, and I loved radio. Mm-hmm. So I bought a white radio, and I was listening to it, and it says to me, how does it work?
Yeah.
Right? And after spending that money to get the radio, I took it all apart. Wow. And I bet you probably maybe 90% of electrical engineers in the world have that same story. Mm. We're problem solvers. And also, me personally, I like to take things from nothing and see them grow into something. Mm. That's very, very, very fulfilling to me. And accomplishing that as an engineer, electrical engineer, it's my way to be fulfilled in life.
Well, that's awesome. Now, Warren, as you know, parents back then, and quite frankly still do, make huge sacrifices to get their kids through college, you know? Sure. What is your recall of the sacrifices your parents would have made in this regard?
You know, the best way for me to provide an answer to that question is to share an experience I had. Now, growing up in Queens, New York, right, going to school and being able to buy my first house, right?
Wow.
Mind you, my how we migrated to the States is my father came up first.
Yeah.
My mother came up shortly thereafter. And my mother is a well-educated woman. She went to one of the top high schools in Guyana, Bishop High School, and that's very prestigious. But when she came up, she had to do domestic work.
Wow.
Right, to get us all sponsored. So my moment of deep appreciation was bought my first house, and I always heard my mother and my father talk about my father having to pick up my mother on Syme Avenue, right? Mm-hmm. And that was Syme Avenue was in New Jersey, right? So when I bought my first house, my mother and father came up. My mother and I took a ride. She says, let's go by Syme Avenue. Wow. So I said, well, Syme Avenue. Then I sat there and I realized, right, she told me, Warren, I'm so proud of you because when I came here in the 60s, I did domestic work in this neighborhood, in this area that was restricted to blacks. And here it is, a generation later, my son is buying a house in the same area, which is West Orange, New Jersey. So that was when I sat down and I said to myself, you know, my parents really made a sacrifice for us to get to where we're at. And that was the moment that deep appreciation sunk in, and I thought I'd share that with you as a way to respond to that question.
Man, I'm getting cold chills as you speak. That is such an incredible, profound story right there, and I hope that folks, passengers on this flight are sort of absorbing it. Mm-hmm. It is quite impressive. Now, Warren, you have built an impressive legacy as one of the most respected electrical engineers, not only in New York, but Georgia and Nevada. Uh-huh. Now, it really was interesting to learn that as a CEO of CCE Consulting Services, you manage a $250 million electronic waste project in Savannah, Georgia.
Right.
And you also served as construction executive for $500 million design hospital in
Washington
D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Now these are just a few major projects that you've involved with. But I want to ask this question: how is work ethic in the United States? Because I know the work ethic is a major problem here in the Caribbean.
Well, I mean it's better in the U.S. For sure. Right. And I never really thought about that question, but I know in terms of work ethic, it depends wholly on the manager and how that manager inspires people. Right. Right? To me, it's sad that I think about this, but you know, you have to motivate people. You have to motivate people to want to do better. So the short answer to your question is, in my experience, the in terms of work ethic, it's better in the U.S. than the Caribbean, but it's not that far apart. Uh-huh. But I just don't rest that right on the individual in terms of them being able to say, hey, look, I want to be ethical when it pertains to work, right? As a manager, as a leader of people, you have to know how to motivate and inspire. And once you motivate and inspire, everything falls into place.
Now, you are currently showcasing your skills with the government of the Bahamas in strategic partnership with the Bahamas Power and Light Company. How did the opportunity come about to form a coalition with the Bahamian government?
It's a full circle moment, and it's a long story. But
make it short.
Thanks to the chairwoman that's sitting to your right, who I didn't know
at the time. To my right. Who's sitting to my right? Oh, there you go.
Long story short, in my professional career, I met a lot of amazing people, right? And I formed relationships with these people. One of them is a gentleman by the name of Everett Fennell. So when I separated from WSP, Everett was one of the first persons to call me up and say, hey, you know, Warren, I think that, you know, what we're doing at my company is great. We'd like you to come on board and just write our business development plan for us, right? So in doing so, I took on that challenge, met it, and through that engagement with ECF, Mr. Fennell, he told me, Warren, I got this project. It's coming. I've got a wonderful person in the Bahamas who is sitting to your right now, and you know, it's great. I want us to go after this. I want you to lead it, et cetera. Right. So, long story short, Ms. Alston wrote the RFP that ECF responded to, and I'm a consultant to ECF. We ended up winning the work. Right. So that's how it all came about. But the challenging thing and the inspirational thing about all of this is that one of the most challenging things I've done in my career was I started a transmission and distribution business inside of an entity that was known for transportation facilities, right?
Wow.
Do you know how challenging that is?
Yeah.
I remember one time going to a prospective client and they did not hear of that company in terms of T&D work. They said to me, Warren, I won't say the company's name.
No, you can't.
But said, Warren, your company is famous for bridges, roads, and tunnels, you know, and you're trying to do what? He said, you know, when we want to build a road and a tunnel, we'll give you a call. That just motivated me more. Right?
Wow.
And turning nothing into something was always a challenge to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a nutshell, it's the career path has been very, very interesting. The work I'm doing now, it's so engaging. And Ms. Alston and I were talking this morning. It's a challenge for me because I see the vision, right? And the Bahamas, they're not just dealing with transmission, separate, right? Distribution, separate, right? Generation, separate. It's a holistic approach, right? And coming from a person that started a transmission and distribution business from scratch, right? And seeing the vision and understanding it, it inspires me more and more to make this thing very, very successful. Right?
Now, one last question before we get back to some music, Warren, and it has to do with you personally. Obviously, the challenges involved with everything that we do, man, and our forbearance is tested in a very serious way. How does it all test your forbearance every single day of the week with these all of these ideas that you have in mind, and which are quite frankly dependent on the strength and the vibe of other people? How does it test your forbearance?
Well, you've got to learn patience. You've got to learn people. You've got to learn people, right? And you've got to understand, you know, the various stakeholders, you know, with everything you do, right? In my position as owner's engineer for the government of the Bahamas and Bahamas Power and Light, the first thing I did, I took a look at the stakeholders and try to understand the stakeholders, the vision, right? So there is nothing really that I don't want to sound like I'm super confident, but there's nothing that really scares me. But it's just the idea, here's a problem, right? How do I solve it?
Yeah.
Right? It's the true nature of an engineer, right? It's not just the electronic wires and all of that, but when you put the people portion into that, it's very, very, very challenging, and it motivates me.
That's awesome. Well, the last thing you said, to your point, motivation. Yeah, I mean, this is truly awesome. We're having an absorbing conversation.
The Beat 104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.
And even our guests are like freaking out over that commercial, because there, quite frankly, isn't a commercial that I've heard, despite the fact that I'm involved with it. I'm not being territorial. I'm just saying, though, there isn't one that embodies exactly what a business is about as 4Play Deli is. That's a great job by Shane Forrester right there, who wrote the lyrics and came up with the idea. His diction was clear. It is clear the extent to which people are coming to see whether or not he's being hyperbolic. But Shane Forrester is perfectly describing what happens with 4Play Deli with the idea of wrapping the rotis in front of you. And this idea came like 28 years ago. Because when I first came around here, I was like, oh, I mean, I want a roti, but I don't like the idea of somebody going to the back and giving me a roti, though. I might order a beef roti and somebody brings a duck roti. Or I might order a lamb roti and somebody bring me a rat roti. You know what I'm saying? That's crazy, right? Mm-hmm. You know? So the whole idea of this democratic way of getting for what you spend for has been expedited by me, initiated by 4Play Deli, quite frankly. All the food is there. You know, in front of you, you make your choices democratically. And a lot of the things that we sell now are actually the ideas that came from customers. For example, like the Republic Roti, which essentially is a coalition of all the meats that we have. That's quite extraordinary. And the Super Roti as well. And then the low carb plates. It's quite exciting. Mm. And in the event that you don't believe me, visit 4Play Deli.
You should hear the description of the Basap.
The Basap shirt, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the Basap shirt is essentially, I know many of you have a white shirt at home. Go there into your closet, just fragment it, tear it up. That's essentially is a bus of shot, but you can't eat it though.
You can't eat it. You can't eat
cloth. It's disgusting.
You can't eat cloth.
It's disgusting. But anyway, neither can we eat energy, but energy provides that source.
So we can eat.
Yeah. Mm. Indeed. That's quite frankly. But I want to both of you get into this second half of our conversation. Absorbing is the word I'd use to describe it. I mean, there have been an inrush of calls into our call center saying the same, yeah? But I'd like to get our conversation beyond the switch with particular reference to your vision for the transformation of the energy landscape in the Bahamas. Now, what's interesting, though, and this is quite interesting in my opinion, is that the International Monetary Fund is saying that the Bahamas appears to be taking advantage of its wealth in solar energy, increasing the share to 30% by 2030. Now, that, quite frankly, sounds a bit lofty, yeah? But having said that, what are some of the ideas that you have, though, with respect to achieving this 30% vision?
So I think, as we established before, you know, the vision came from PM Davis, and, you know, he gave us the tools we needed to really make that vision or bring that vision to fruition. So one of the things that we looked at was a plethora, a cornucopia, if you might, of different ways of integrating the 30% renewables. Recognizing that, so let's start with some real, real basics, right, in the energy sector. So one of the first thing that I like to tell people is, when there's no sun, there's no solar. Let's start there. When there's no sun, there's no solar. And we generate electricity 8,760 hours a year. Yet solar in parts of the Bahamas only are at 1,500 hours per year. Mm. So you automatically say, wait a minute. So you mean energy is produced 8760, but you only have 1500 hours of solar? Yes. So we already have a limitation built in from our geography. And more, and even down here in Barbados, you all are probably close to like 2,600 hours, right? So you still have 6,000 hours that you have to generate. So we started with that. Then we looked at the geography and we clearly recognized, you know, most of the time you need about, you know, 3.5 to 5 acres of land for every megawatt that you generate. And so for a country like the Bahamas, where a lot of our land masses are very small, we clearly recognize, okay, this island, no solar because it's too small. This island, yes, solar because it has more land. And so we balanced that across the entire archipelago. We also looked at utility scale solar for New Providence because it's one of the few islands where you have the kind of demand that you can put in quite a bit of solar. But in order to do that, one of the things we quickly recognized is we had to improve the transmission and distribution. It doesn't matter if you put all this solar on if the grid cannot accept it. And so we went about and we... The first thing we did, or one of the first things we did, was we created a, what is called request for proposals. So we created two sets of requests for proposals. One set was for the family islands in terms of microgrids and hybrid microgrids. So let me break that down for you. A microgrid is usually when we talk about maybe like solar and batteries. A hybrid microgrid has some sort of fossil fuel generation. So now you've got fossil fuel generation. You've got solar, you've got battery energy storage systems, and they work in concert to provide energy. Utility scale solar is a little different because your grid, your transmission and distribution grid, is large enough that it can actually ebb and flow with your demand. So those were how the projects were set up. So now you've gotten into that. In addition to that, because we wanted to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, we looked at fuel switching. So what we did was we're bringing in liquefied natural gas. So right now we're using HFO, which is heavy fuel oil, and we also use ADO, which is automotive diesel. Both of those have significant GHG footprint, not only when you use it, but what's left over once you consume it. And so by moving to a gas, a lot of that GHG footprint will go away. So we are taking not only the solar and the renewables, but we're also pairing it with other technologies to help us along the way.
Now, Warren, I'm curious about this. I'd like to know your thoughts. You know, climate change as it relates to energy. We all know the islands of the Caribbean have been, for a long time, susceptible to tropical storms and hurricanes. We saw the devastation in the Grenadines only last year. And the destruction there was in the Bahamas, where you're from, in 2019. The power outages, those events were excruciating, and the economic fallout had been substantial. My question is, how can a more efficient means of electrical production and consumption prepare us here in the Caribbean for the growing threat of climate change?
Well, as mentioned, these projects in the Bahamas, they're a combination of hybrid microgrids and microgrid projects, right? Throughout the world, and especially there's been a phenomenon, not a phenomenon, but there's a term called non-wired solutions, right? And what that is basically a hurricane comes, it knocks down a pole, the line comes down, the power goes out, right? The advantage of having these hybrid microgrids and microgrids in the vicinity same vicinity as the load is that you're relying less on wired solutions, right? To provide energy to people, to consumers of that energy, right? Mother Nature is undefeated, right? Yeah. But what you do is if you can think about efficient ways, right, non-wired solutions, and also I explained to you last night over dinner about resiliency and how when there's a storm, it's amazing how the utilities all over, right, they band together to pour the resources where they're needed, right, to get the power back up. So, again, you know, Mother Nature is undefeated, right? We've got very smart people thinking about ways to rely less on those things that can be damaged to cause outages, right? And that's how we make a bad situation
good,
a little bit better for folks, right?
Now, Christina, this one is for you. Now, it is rather daunting to think that another hurricane season is on the way. Now, how would you describe the level of apprehension there usually is amongst Bahamians, rather, as every season approaches?
So I think it's the same apprehension that we have all over the Caribbean. We all recognize, is it us this year or is it somebody else?
Yeah.
I mean, it just is, you know. And one of the things that Warren just said is that, you know, utility people as a whole, we are first responders like everybody else. When storms are coming, we see them and we know what the impact can be.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the things is we have CARELEC, which is an association of all of the Caribbean electrical companies, and we will band together as well. But it is something that we all have to live with. And so in doing so, what we're doing in the Bahamas right now is that resiliency solution. And one of the things that I'm really excited about is when we start looking and talking about restoration and these non-wired alternatives, it'll be a testament to the rest of the Caribbean is how do you serve your most vulnerable communities in a way that can get them up and running as fast as possible. So as Warren said, you know, Mother Nature is undefeated. You know, there is always apprehension. You're always prepared or getting prepared. You know, each one of us as Caribbean nations, we walk into hurricane season with the roll of the dice. You know, is it us? Is it somebody else? You know, I mean, but we're always trying to pay attention to what everyone else is doing. And so it is hopeful that as we move forward into not only the climate change, but the aspects of resiliency, our microgrids now a solution set to help us bring customers back on. Because at the end of the day, yes, there's going to be devastation. Yes, you're going to have problems. But can we get customers back on as quickly as possible?
Mm-hmm. Now, Christine, I want to talk about the ways in which politics, in many instances, become an impediment to change and transformation in the Caribbean. Obviously, the Bahamas isn't exempted. Have you experienced any challenges adjusting to the political realities of your ambitions?
So I would say, again, you know, we're really blessed to have a leader such as Minister Jo Beth Colby Davis. I mean, she is visionary in this, and she has given us the support and the everything that we need to get the job done. Mm-hmm. Because she came from the energy industry, she understands what has to happen. She's really quite a force of nature. I know that we've talked about, you know, at some point in the future, having her here to really talk about policies and community engagement. But it is such an exciting time. And sometimes you just have to sit back and think about, we seem to be in that moment in time where all of the heavens have aligned to get us there. There's always going to be politics, but the fact that we were able to get the request for proposals out and we were successful in getting, you know, independent power producers to come to the Bahamas and make the investment. The fact that we were able to get with the, you know, the Attorney General's office and have them do the negotiations with Shell. All of these things that have gotten us to this point, it is such an incredible experience and journey for us. The fact that we were able to pair up with a really great owner's engineer to stand as the engineer on behalf of the government and representing the Bahamian people in this effort. You know, we've done some of the calculations and we think that the total investment in all these projects is probably close to $1.7 billion. And so it is going to be a testament to how you can do this. And so we, you know, we'd love to see people come, learn about it, and be able to replicate what we're doing in the Bahamas and the rest of the Caribbean.
Now, which brings me perfectly to my next question. Warren, I suppose as energy professionals, a large part of what you do is prioritizing the long term. But how do you see the benefits your program bring to what will ultimately bring to Bahamians, aside from putting money in their pockets?
Well, it's a good question, and matter of fact, Christina had that this very same discussion this morning. It's not about the money, per se. right? But because Bahamians will be paying less for energy, they will have more options with the money they save, right? When I say options, right?
I get what you're saying, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Food, mm-hmm. medicine, school clothes.
Surplus.
You name it. Surplus, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So so it's not, when people say besides putting more money in their pocket, is that extra money they're putting in their pocket, what will they be able to do with it?
And that essentially drives the economy because
absolutely,
there's more spending power, right?
No question. Mm-hmm. No question.
Right. Now, it's interesting that both of you, mm-hmm. as I have essentially experienced the childhood realities of growing up in the Caribbean, yeah? You therefore would have an understanding of how it is back in the day, how it was back in the day, mm-hmm. of the kerosene oil, you remember mm-hmm. that? Kerosene oil stoves mm-hmm. and the candle and the mm-hmm. the oil lamps, you mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Now, to what extent has this sobering experience impacted your view on the importance of modern day electrical services or electricity?
So I'm going to take that because, you know, I feel like I'm a little closer mm-hmm. than Warren. So I cannot tell you how humbling an experience it is for me to sit in this space. Mm. I don't think that people, you know, as an engineer and being able to understand what the lack of electricity does to people. Mm. And, you know, many people in the Caribbean, you know, just like the Bahamas, we are facing an aging population. And one of the things that we know is that as people age, they cannot regulate their body temperature. And so what we are seeing in the Bahamas is a lot of people are buying more of the small air conditioning units for family members. I did it for myself. My uncle was very sick. And so his family, they put in the AC unit so he could be comfortable because he couldn't regulate his body temperature. And to Warren's point is, as we're seeing this, these are those societal benefits. And so for me, it's a visceral experience. It's emotional because what you're recognizing is you do not want people to suffer. And you never want energy to become a social issue.
Right.
We want people to be able to have electricity when they need it. And we, as that generation, that sandwich generation, we know that small children are the same way. They get overheated very quickly. And as you would have said, we are experiencing a climate increase where we're having higher temperatures. And so we are only going to use more and more energy. And we don't want people having to make a choice between their light bill, their medication, and their food. Mm. And so it is a very, to me, it's a very emotional situation that we are trying to solve.
Mm-hmm. Now, guys, we have reached the twilight of our conversation. I therefore like to digress into another area of conversation that quite frankly, is of interest mm-hmm. to all of us. Now, Warren, mm-hmm. you are from the red state of Georgia. I'm aware that many who voted for the Republican Party disagrees with President Trump's policies, especially as it relates to tariffs, immigration, and now the birthright issue. What have you been hearing, though, from the people you know in Georgia? And what is your take? Mm.
That's a loaded question. to be honest with you, it's my take on what's happened in the U.S., and harken back to what you said earlier when you're introducing me to your audience, right? I migrated to the States when I was about 8 years old. So I grew up in the States. Fell in love with the founding principles, right, of the United States, the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and all of that. I digress, but let me answer your question.
Yeah.
Mr. Trump did not come out of the blue, right? We had 4 years of him before this current term that he has. The man tells you what he's going to do, how he's going to do it. He's not secretive about any of that. And knowing that, it wasn't me, but knowing that persons voted for him, a majority of the electorate voted for that. So now you're saying you're upset, you're surprised. How could you be surprised when the man is telling you, told you exactly what he's going to do, and he's doing it, right? So I kind of like, it's my way of dealing with that situation. I just tune out. I just tune out. I don't want to hear the belly aching. I don't want to hear the complaints, because this should not have been a surprise to you, right? So you know, only time will tell, you know, what's going to happen with that whole situation. But as a person who migrated to the States at a very young age, bought into the founding principles of the United States, and you know, still proud, right, of being a citizen of the States, is just surprising to me that all these institutions, these founding principles that you thought were bedrock, you know, is at risk.
Now, it's interesting that the president campaigned on reducing inflation, mm-hmm. and essentially making it easier for the working class in America. Now, he's asking Americans, quote, take some pain. What are your thoughts?
He has no comment.
off mic, we said we just tuned out.
It's let me just put it this way, right? During the first term, my a typical Trump supporter to me was somebody who was not well informed, right? But after the second term, you're seeing well-informed people, you know, buying into that, right? And you've heard people who were very, 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 had a huge voice when inflation went up under Biden. Mm-hmm. They're quiet now. Wow. You know, where's the consistency? You know, where is that consistent message?
And to your point, though, before I forget, that mm-hmm. Walmart has just said that there will be mm-hmm. price increases. How would that impact on the working class?
It'll impact the working class a lot. Mm. Just what we mentioned about the Bahamian people having more money in their pocket due to paying less for energy, mm-hmm. right? So price increases takes money out of people's pockets, especially the working class. Yeah. Now they have less options, mm-hmm. right?
Wow. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the last question in this absorbing conversation. I use the word absorbing with lavish conviction mm-hmm. based on the response we're getting from our social media platforms here. Now, and this last question is for you, Christina. Now, the U.S. trade policy is of desperate, and you heard me use the word desperate, concern mm-hmm. to all of us here in the Caribbean, and indeed Americans. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you see its implications for the Bahamas? And how do you reckon should the CARICOM's collective posture in order to cushion the impact of these economic tariffs?
So let's break this down into a couple parts. One of the things that, you know, we're in the middle of building microgrids and with our independent power producers. And one of the things that the minister quickly did with the Energy Committee was to ensure that we had diversity of supply, mm-hmm. meaning that we don't have the same people building microgrids across the archipelago. As a matter of fact, I think we have a total of 8 vendors. Mm-hmm. I might be right, 8 vendors who are building the various projects. What that gives us is diversity of supply chain. Mm. And in doing so, we are going to be pulling equipment from all over the world. So will the tariffs impact us? Yes. But to the extent that if we had only gone with, say, an American supplier, then the answer is no. And diversity is what protects you in your supply chain from these types of issues. So further to that conversation, let's talk about it from a Caribbean standpoint. So one of the things that I'm, you know, we've talked about, like, you know, my kind of North Star, and my North Star is always trying to sit in that position where people have a high energy burden, are food insecure, and medically underserved. And so if I'm tackling the first issue, which is high energy burden, my second issue is food insecurity. And so, you know, indoor agriculture is a big passion of mine. Everybody who talks to me knows that I'm very interested in indoor agriculture. To kind of give you a thought process on that, is if you, the 20-foot containers that they use for indoor agriculture, they use only 10% of the water. Mm-hmm. It's all organic. Because one of the things that we know is that when we import foodstuffs, those foodstuffs decline in nutritional value exponentially by the time they get to you. And so it's not just a question of how do we use energy, but it is a question now of beneficial electrification, mm-hmm. meaning how can we shore up our energy supply and use various types of technology like indoor agriculture or all of these like animal husbandry and all of these things to our benefit to feed ourselves. Food security has to be just as important. And to me, it goes hand in hand with energy transformation. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, listen, man, look, I want to thank both of you for coming this afternoon and sharing your expertise and your thoughts. And I have to say to both of you, I really appreciate the fact that you guys actually flew in from Atlanta to do the show. I am totally humbled beyond my imagination because this is the first time in 10 years this has happened. Mm-hmm. And it is indeed the first time that there have been two guests here from a different mm-hmm. country talking about issues that are relevant to all Barbadians, quite frankly, because the information has been substantial. And I want to thank you so much for coming and being part of this absorbing conversation beyond the switch. And Christina, I'd like to invite you to an event here in October that we're doing called a woman's empowerment gala called Earning Your Strength. And it's scheduled to be dynamic, powerful women like yourself with great stories. If you've just
exemplified,
you know, owning your strength 2025 is going to be in October. The details are yet to be finalized, but surely we'll be in touch and we'll definitely have a conversation. But thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Warren. God bless you.
Thank you. Thank
yeah,
you, thank
and I hope your vision manifests into great stuff. And I can say, well, look. These guys were on the flight talking about it.
That's right.
Thank
That's
you so
right.
much for coming.
You're Thank welcome. You for having us.
You're welcome.
Great stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was Christina Alsa, chairperson of Bahamian Light, and Warren Andrews from Atlanta, Georgia, giving their perspective on climate change and the way it impacts our energy situation in the world. We continue right now with the music. And our passengers are looking at me, Captain Forrester. I want to dance with my girlfriend, though. Seriously. Mm. I want to dance with my girlfriend. So you got to play a love tune for me. We are now 80 miles southeast of Classics International Airport. We'll be landing shortly. In preparation for landing, please ensure that your seat belts are securely fastened and your tray tables stowed. Our cabin attendants will be coming around the aisles to retrieve any service items you may have used on board our flight this afternoon. Remember, smoking is strictly prohibited until you exit the terminal building here at Classics International Airport. This is the end of flight to Classics for today, Sunday, May 17th. It really was an absolute 18th. I'm sorry. It really was an absolute delight bringing it to you on behalf of our featured guests from Atlanta, Georgia, Warren Andrews, and chairwoman of the Bahamas Power and Light, Christina Alsen, also from Atlanta. This is Captain Forrester saying good night on behalf of my proficient co-pilot, Malcolm X, who's always correcting me in times of error. Thank you so much, Captain Forrester. Malcolm X.
You're most welcome. I didn't realize they give the date because it's a transatlantic flight. We left on the 17th. We're landing on the 18th.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Classics International Airport. Local time is approximately 5 p.m. For your safety and comfort, please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until the captain turns off the fastened seatbelt sign. This will indicate that we have parked at the gate and that it is safe for you to move about. On behalf of the entire crew, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this trip, and we're looking forward to seeing you on board again in the near future. Have a nice day.
Chinese cuisine at its best.
Foreplay Deli's got it.
We've got that taste you won't forget.
Foreplay Deli.
Oh, how we aim to please ya. We wrap the rotis in front of ya. Great service with a smile. Got your taste buds going wild. Rice and beef, salt, fish, chicken, lamb, and doubles on the list. You just can't refuse it at Foreplay Deli. We got the taste you won't forget.
Foreplay Deli, located at Sheraton Mall.